Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Allison Lee, one of the co-hosts of the channel and associate professor of art history at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Today, I'm excited to be interviewing Andrew Spira about his new book, Foreshadowed, Malevich's Black Square and Its Precursors. Let me begin by telling you a little bit more about my guest. Andrew Spira is an art historian, author, curator, and lecturer who has written numerous books, including The Avant-Garde Icon, Russian Avant-Garde Art and the Icon Painting Tradition, and The Invention of the Self, Personal Identity in the Age of Art. He graduated from the Courtauld Institute before working at the Temple Gallery, where he developed a passion for Russian art. For several years, he was a curator at the Victoria and Albert Museum, focusing on the collections of silver, metalwork, and jewelry, and he subsequently joined Christie's Education, where he was a program director for 14 years. The book he wrote, which we'll be discussing today, explores a painting known as the Black Square, a radical artwork which astounded audiences when it was first exhibited in Russia in 1915. According to Andrew, no one had ever seen anything like it before. And yet, it does have precedence. In fact, over the 500 years before it was painted, several artists, writers, philosophers, and scientists had landed on the form of the Black Square or similar rectangles. Exploring these predecessors reveals layers of meaning that are often overlooked, but are deeply relevant to understanding Malevich's most enigmatic painting. Needless to say, I am thrilled to get to discuss this book with its author today, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Andrew Spira, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's such a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you for asking me.
We're going to dive right in here. I want to ask you a sort of traditional introductory question before we launch into talking about this book, which I really am very excited to discuss with you. I wonder if you might begin by telling us a little bit just about yourself, maybe where you're from originally, how you became interested in art history. And of course, I want to know how you became interested in Russian art in particular. So just kind of give us some of your background, if you would.
Certainly. I'm a Londoner. I was born in London, and I've lived in London for most of my life with a little foray into the countryside in my teenage years. But otherwise, I've been in the city all the time. And I've been involved in art history since I was about 16 or 17. I have artists in my family, and so art was very much a part of my life. And I became a student of art history when I was about 16, 17, went to the Courtauld Institute and studied 12th century art. I specialized in that very brief period, which was possible to do in those those days. So I had a really blissful time spending many months looking at manuscripts, looking at metalwork, looking at architecture and so on and so forth. So I was very narrowly focused on the Middle Ages primarily. And even Byzantium didn't feature very much in the picture at that time. But I befriended a specialist dealer in Russian and Byzantine icons when I was there. And I used to go to his gallery and hang out and go to talks that he gave. And by slow degrees, I became more knowledgeable about Byzantine art and Russian art altogether. And it was really through his initiative that I became involved. I would travel to Russia, visiting medieval churches and medieval cities. His name's Dick Temple. Some Russophiles will be familiar with him. He runs the Temple Gallery, which has been in existence for, well over half a century now. And it really was the sort of hub of icon painting interests for many, many years. And I became friends with him, traveled to Vladimir, Suzdal, Kiev, and so on and so forth with him, which was hugely inspirational. And then eventually I began working in his gallery, which was a great privilege and great pleasure. And so I learned very much on the job. It was all very new to me, but I learned by handling the objects, and it was very thrilling. And then one thing led to another in a very evolutionary way. Which was fascinating. I was planning to put on an exhibition of the relationship between Russian icons and Russian avant-garde art. It occurred to me when I was sitting in the gallery for hour upon hour that there was a sort of uncanny resemblance between the two. And so I thought a small exhibition with another art gallery, commercial art gallery in London, would be an interesting project. So I started researching this, thinking it would take me a month or so, but it was a terrible mistake to think that. And I suddenly realized it. There was just so much more material than I dreamt of that it took me 20 years to really pad it all out in my mind. And I ended up publishing a book on the subject in 2008 on the relationship between the two. So it was very organic and evolutionary accident in a certain sense. And I started traveling to Russia a lot, often taking groups to visit cultural sites. And it was an evolutionary journey. And by slow degrees, the icons and the avant-garde began to meet in the middle, and suddenly I began to have a total picture of Russian art altogether, whereas I tended to leapfrog over the 18th century for quite a few years. But eventually they joined, and it all fell into place, and it continues to be a great passion of mine.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of what you're describing is evident in this book. And, you know, I want to talk about those elements, but maybe before we launch into the material itself or specific questions I have, I always like to ask, you know, how writing this particular book foreshadowed about Malevich's Black Square and these precursors, how did it come about, you know, as a book? It can be, for those of us, you know, who are art historians, you know, things can be passions, but we never ultimately turn them into publications sometimes. So how did this happen?
Well, this is quite a quirky book because it's not exactly art history, because it's not a history of the Black Square, which has been written quite a lot, nor is it really about influences, because much of the material covered in the book was not known to Malevich himself. So it's a little bit oblique in that sense. It's got a sort of intuitive dimension to it. And so I didn't sort of push it as a research project in myself, but I began to just notice black squares, as one does after a while. And I thought three or four of them. I mean, Robert Flood's famous The Universe Before the Creation of the World, 1617, is perhaps the best known of the precursors, and it's been cited in many books on the subject. And I picked up two or three or four and then five of these, and it just began to cohere in my mind as a bigger issue. I think what really pushed me over the line is when I realized that Pavlov had used black squares in his experiments with dogs. And when I discovered that, I thought that is a sign from the beyond that this has got to become more than just a curiosity, but it really is a phenomenon. And then it actually came very, very quickly.
Mm. Well, you have set me up beautifully for a bunch of the questions that I had or a bunch of things that I wanted to dig into. I'm glad you described this book as quirky, because I think it is very, very much an unusual piece. I mean, I want to ask you, the structure of it is somewhat unusual. It's basically a kind of long form essay. But before we dig into these particulars and the ways that this isn't art history, which, it really isn't. And I found it very refreshing in that sense. And I want to ask you more about that. But maybe we need to lay, a little bit of groundwork here, just for our listeners who haven't read the book, maybe are thinking of getting the book, in terms of what it's about and how it works and kind of what you do in here. So maybe it's best if I say right off the bat, full sort of transparency, that I loved the opening line of this book, Andrew. It grabbed me from the very beginning. In a very short preface before you launch into the remainder of the sort of primary meat, the text of the book, you say, "For years, I have tried to convince students that Malevich's Black Square is the most interesting and beautiful painting ever made." Oh, I love this line. And I think, and it immediately appealed to me, maybe again, full transparency. I teach Malevich and the Black Square specifically, I would say several times a year, in the fall and in the spring semester. In fact, I just taught it in class yesterday and before our Thanksgiving break last week, and I'm teaching it in my third upper level seminar tomorrow. So it's like Black Square bonanza time of year for me. And I think you're so right that this business of convincing students or people in general that this is a really special piece, that's not an easy or self-evident thing. I think it's some of the heaviest lifting I do all semester in terms of this sell is hard. So maybe by way of sort of getting into what you do in this book, can I ask you, why do you think it's such a tough sell, this, that it's the most beautiful, most interesting, as you say, painting ever made?
Well, people come to art with expectations of a kind implicitly. And this picture really delivers nothing in that respect. All your expectations of narrative, sensation, self-expression, none of that really operates. And so the conventional frame of reference in which art appreciation happens isn't there. And a lot of people think that's vapid and possibly even bloody-minded on the part of the artist. And there's no doubt about it, Malevich was being challenging. But I think there's a significance about the painting that is profound. And often we look at works of art from a purely historical point of view, as if their significance is to complete a historical narrative. But there is, I think, an experiential dimension to art appreciation that is terribly important and is often forgotten. And so I want to bring that to the forefront. And really, the significance of Malevich's painting, I think, shouldn't just be seen as historical. I think we should allow ourselves to taste its intended significance as an experience, if you see what I mean. And that really is what he was really saying, I think, with the picture, is that we don't need art anymore to connect us with the depth in ourselves. If you think about music and painting, conventionally speaking, if you want to, you've got time at home and you want to relax, you go and put on a piece of music. And really what you're doing with that is you're manipulating your circumstance to induce a kind of experience in yourself, to facilitate a kind of contact with a depth in yourself that is not otherwise there. And Malevich was really progressively saying that art is functioning as a kind of crutch in that capacity. If we're constantly using it to induce experiences of depth in ourselves. And he was saying that if you wean yourself off this addiction to art, the mediation of art, you can actually contact that depth immediately. That is to say, unmediated. So he with the Black Square, he's really taking us to the brink, to the brink of the canyon. And now he's saying, put your money where your mouth is and dive into the experience of depth. You don't need the crutch of art to mediate or license your access to depth. Depth is your nature. It is innate in experience. Do you see what I mean? And so you can relinquish.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
So the relinquishing of art is actually a liberation, because you are becoming empowered in yourself to be the profundity that we constantly seek somewhere else. And that, I think, is a beautiful gift. If you can receive that gift, it is a moment of great beauty. So we're not talking about aesthetic experience alone. Having said that, when you become very familiar with a picture, it does become, in a strange way, physically very beautiful. And I love it. I love the texture of it. I love the slightly misshapen quality of it. It's not a cold, clinical piece of geometry. It's got a lot of character. And its story just reinforces that, because it's all the sort of neo-primitivism that precedes it in Malevich's work is present there. He didn't just switch off and become a cool character. Far from it. It's very passionate and primal object, and it has this really liberating dimension. I think it's still a live issue. How do we access depth in ourselves without depending on mediation, whether it's art or technology or landscape or whatever it might be? We're constantly encouraged to seek it outside of ourselves, and he's giving us permission, as it were, to find it in ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Oh, everything you said was just so beautiful. And I mean, now I'm thinking, I'm going to assign this podcast episode, this interview, to my students, and they'll understand everything they need to know about it without me in the first 5 minutes or whatever here. Gosh, I'm trying to think. All my questions seem so mundane now in the face of such poetic ideas.
It is also a mundane painting, of course.
It is
comedic as well. It is absurd. It is an absurd painting, and that's part of its history. If you look at some of the paintings that he was painting shortly before the Black Square, and indeed on the very canvas of the Black Square itself, it's painted over a number of pictures. There's a lot of absurdity in there. And he wasn't just dismantling the visual world in an elegant and graceful way, like the Cubists, for instance. He was positively interrupting that process and forcing it to become contorted and jarring imagery and truncated words and things of this kind. He was quite inelegant about it as well. So I think one shouldn't project a kind of architectural clarity and pristine.
Yeah, no way. I definitely don't when I teach it. Well, you know, maybe the last thing that you were saying does lead me back to some of these notes that I took and sort of things that I wanted to ask you about. You know, it's hard because I think I found that there were so many ideas in the book or arguments you put forward, though they're subtle, that I found intriguing. I mean, that just really seemed to awaken something new, even in someone like me I've read vast amounts of the scholarship on this painting, though there's so much, I don't know that you could tackle all of it ever. But I'll even admit that one of them that you put forward fairly early in the text, this idea that the Black Square is, as you call it, an archaeological site, incorporating its own past within itself materially. I thought, you know, that's so well said. And I actually already incorporated that into the lecture I gave yesterday. I described it just that way, that it's an archaeological site. And I used it to sort of segue to one of the most interesting things about the painting, like you already mentioned, that Malevich reused the canvas, and that there are two earlier paintings underneath the work that we now see today. So I'm not sure like exactly what I want to ask you about this. You also talk about, as you were just referencing, Malevich's alogical works from the year or two before the Black Square, including the composition with the Mona Lisa from 1914, which is another quite famous work, again, a kind of precursor on the way to the Black Square, and how it involves forms of occlusion, the layering of images and forms eclipsing each other, and how this relates to iconoclasm. I mean, I just really loved the sort of story that the journey you took us on in that section and a number of other places. And maybe my question is about, how you came to these arguments or ideas. You know, how did you lock into the way that this thing flows? Because I think there is a really interesting flow to it overall. Sometimes you're talking about Malevich's Black Square, and then other times you move away from it and you always come back to it. I mean, it's just nice.
It is a very paradoxical painting, and I'm sure it's meant to be. One of the paradoxes is that it erases its associations. It pretends or claims to have no associations. That's part of its iconography, is that it stands independent of all associations, because associations are something that the mind will latch onto and make interpretations around and so on. So by eliminating associations, both external via subject matter and internal via composition, it really is just becoming a kind of existential object. And that's part of the conceit, you could say. So it's doubly paradoxical that it is actually painted over these other pictures, which are become a part of the body of the painting. And so I think one has to see it in that context as well. You can take it out of history on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's very much, its history is a part of its genesis. And I think it is important. It has a kind of momentum. If you think of momentum, is really the kind of tension in a moment that has been built up by the past, you could say. And this picture has momentum in it. It has the force of the past in it, in a certain sense, even if you can't see it in historical references and things of that kind. So I think that paradox is interesting, that it's an independent, a standalone object, but its history, every object has history, but its history is materially present in it, I think is very fascinating when you look at it as an object and not just as an image, or as a substance and not just a surface, you could say, which you have to do, I think. And another thing that I think is relevant to this is that, yes, it does put all associations to one side, but it was famously displayed when it was first displayed in 1915 across the corner of the gallery space, as many followers of Malevich will be aware, but some of your listeners may not be. It was displayed across the corner of the room, which to any Russian will have immediately signified icon painting, because icons, the sacred art of the Russian Orthodox Church, were hung across the corners in Russian homes, and there will be nobody who missed that association. So Malevich is getting rid of associations on the one hand with regard to the painting in itself, but generating them on that occasion from the way he exhibited the painting. And so again, you see this double movement: independence, but associations. And that association is to do with the sacred status of the picture's significance, which I mentioned earlier. So he's constantly playing this double game, I think, not necessarily strategically, but it's just two levels of interpretation that one can always bring to bear on it.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly.
One thing that's constantly overlooked in the famous photograph of the exhibition in 1915, when the painting's hung across the corner, first of all, is the neoclassical molding in the ceiling, which I think is very, very interesting, because, of course, it places the picture in the context of a much bigger history, in a certain sense, because that molding is a sign of a kind of aristocratic grandeur and all the values of the Roman Empire as they resonated through the ages. So that, I think, is an interesting detail. Also, there's a chair, an empty chair in the picture, which, again, has a kind of poetry about it that I think is very affecting. And, this is part of the historical reality of the experience around the picture. So one's constantly zooming into it as an absolute object and then zooming out to see how it functioned in its environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked your discussion of that crown molding across the top. What I think was so effective about your book was the way that, even just brief mentions of things would make me look back at whether it's that documentary photograph, which I feel like I've seen 1,000 times and never thought there was anything new to see in it. But yeah, I did. I somehow missed that. I mean, maybe that's my own oversight. But yeah, there were a lot of gifts in this book in terms of not just, and we haven't even really started talking about the precursors yet, but just in terms of, as it says on the back cover, your discussion of these precursors and in this sort of long form essay overall, recalibrates your understanding of the painting, even if the things that you're talking about as being precursors to the Black Square were not things that Malevich necessarily ever saw or knew about. I mean, that's just a really intriguing thing that you built. Let me maybe go back for a moment and ask you, I keep sort of foreshadowing, that's the first one I'm going to say, foreshadowing, and it's the title of the book. I want to ask you about the structure of the book, because I think it, maybe halfway through, it started to strike me that it is essentially a long-form essay. I mean, I don't know, maybe you can tell us what the overall word count of it ended up being. It's very readable, don't get me wrong, but there are no sections, there are no parts, there are no chapters, there are no breaks. It just flows. And you know, as someone who writes books, I immediately thought, ooh, this is so interesting. It's so different from how most books of this kind of subject in art history or on art in general are structured. It made me think that you really wanted your reader to sit and just take this whole thing in sort of in one go. And that is how I read it. I mean, I just sat an afternoon and I don't know how long it took me, a couple of hours, and read it, you know, beginning to end. And I wonder if there had been chapters, I might have stopped, right? I might have put a bookmark in and picked it up a couple of days later. So how strategic was this long form essay structure to your writing?
It was a bit, it's a good question. It was a bit, but I didn't know it was going to be like that at the beginning. It's about 22,000 words, I think. So yes, it's not very long. And if it had been longer, I think it would have been impossible to have this unstructured design in some sense. There were various reasons for it. One is that the themes blend into each other so seamlessly that I didn't want to impose a kind of artificial break between them. I could have done that. I did think about it. And occasionally when I was writing it, I did stick in thematic headings just to help me organize the material. But then I would take them out again. So one could talk about the comedic aspect of it. There's a lot about absurdity and comic material. There's a lot about mourning. There's a lot about metaphysics. There's a certain amount about politics. All of these could have been themes. But I felt by prioritizing the simplicity of the theme, I was losing a kind of fluidity that I feel is very important to the overall experience of the book. So I was really, I came to think of it as a kind of tone poem. In the 19th century, you begin to get composers who, instead of writing symphony, it's not symphonic in any shape or form, but composers would write symphonies in sonata form with four movements, and the movements would follow a certain pattern. And then at the end of the 19th century, you begin to get composers who write these tone poems, which are just long bits of fabric. In a certain sense, they don't necessarily fall into this conventional structure, and they're not symmetrical. They determine their own structure, and they can last anything in between sort of 10 and 40 minutes. Sibelius wrote them, Liszt wrote them, Schoenberg wrote them in the early 20th century, and that structure eventually appealed to me more. So it's a kind of asymmetrical tone poem that allows for a certain amount of improvisation within the overall flow.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you answering that. I think these episodes or these interviews have become more and more I'm asking authors about sometimes about the mechanics of the writing, about stylistic choices they made. And, you know, I hope that I think we have a good amount of graduate students and things who listen to this. So I always hope that it's helpful to them. When I have an author like you who, I mean, it's just a very sophisticated beautiful writer. I always want to, you know, I want to know, I want to sort of dig into the choices you made. And I'm glad to hear that what you said about the practicalities, where you added sections and then took them out. And
It's a very important part of the process of writing. Rather, it's Malevich's painting conceals the mechanism, which we can see with x-rays and so on. Yes, there are mechanisms that you use consciously, unconsciously. You build some scaffolding to do something, then you take the scaffolding down again. I think the craft of writing is a very interesting one. I really enjoy it, and it makes a lot of difference. The structuring of ideas is a very fascinating one. I think the structure of the book as a basically linear experience is fascinating, and it comes with conditions. I think the fact that we read books, for instance, in relation to the internet, I think it's very interesting that the book is a fairly structured and linear experience. The internet is, to me, is more like a globe. There's nowhere to start and there's nowhere to end. You just spin the globe and read it. You'll never get the whole story. You'll never find the beginning. You'll never find the end, which has its own potential. A book, on the other hand, enjoys a certain limitation, which I like, because it means that you can really be comprehensive in your approach to an idea. So it becomes like an art form in a certain sense. And I think the sense of the completeness and the structure are important. So yes, I did enjoy that when writing it.
You know, as you're talking about it, the more I'm thinking about it, I'm realizing too. I'll give you a little bit of credit where it's due here. In my humble opinion, I think it's much harder to write like you did, without section breaks and headers and little and sort of pauses. Because it means you just have to have such good transitions constantly. And when I think about, and maybe this leads kind of to my next question, another thing that was really cool about this book was the vast spans of time that you drew together. Again, without sort of, you know, needing to stop and start a new section called Morning or start a new section called Icons, it just seamlessly blended from one era and back and forth. And I mean, that's a very special thing. And I started kind of thinking, knowing what I do about your background, does this come from teaching, sort of your ability to encapsulate these large periods of time and draw the threads together? Is it maybe from the tours that you lead, you know, where in museums you are sort of having to draw together vast periods of time, depending on the structure of the museum, the rooms you're entering? Maybe it was your time at Christie's. How did you get so good at doing that?
Thank you for putting it that way. It's something I've always been very fascinated by is, well, the modes of experience, the ways we experience these things, not just taking the objects in isolation, but having a much rounder and richer picture of that. So all of these different practices have really fed into the work. I feel that the impact of history on us is not just of academic interest. It's a kind of profound, as I was mentioned earlier, has a kind of momentum that I think deeply affects us. And I think our capacity to understand and interpret works of art is itself subject to historical development. So I've been very interested in this rather syncretic view of world culture, you could say, which is why I think it was meaningful to write a book that's not chronological particularly, as in this case. But most of my work does revolve around a kind of historical trajectory, because I think the way our understanding ideas, the way our understanding unfolds in a historical sense is so important. I don't think we are as free to understand things as we think we are. I think our mental capacities, you could say, are determined by history as much as the things we study. And so I like to have a very open open view of the world and not get sort of drawn into a narrow perspective too much. So all the things you mentioned, curating, for instance, is terribly important, curating ideas. When you've got a limited collection, for instance, how are you going to put it together in such a way that the objects speak to each other? You're going to have to bring out themes that facilitate that kind of contact. When you travel abroad, for instance, you don't visit places in chronological order on the whole. Do you? It would be hard work. I dare say some people try to. So all of these, and teaching, of course, is a wonderful privilege because the students generate so many ideas. They throw you so many curved balls that it's wonderful to constantly have that input. And of course, by teaching, you're constantly testing out your ideas on students. So it's a very, very interesting and fruitful two-way experience. All my experiences feed into it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I couldn't agree with you more in terms of teaching being a privilege and how it is a sort of maybe the initial testing ground for ideas. And the more years I teach, the more I feel like it's absolutely inbuilt into my research and my writing and sort of how that all comes about in ways I never anticipated years ago as a graduate student. Everything you said just now about, you know, the book not being chronological, about it having this syncretic kind of method, if I might call it that, maybe being a little bit too rigorous about it. But, you know, this was one of the other things that was an aspect of the book I found so intriguing. The whole time I was reading it, I kept being struck by what almost hit me as a kind of like anti-historical move. And I don't mean that in any sort of negative way. Like, I mean it in the best possible way. You are not, for the most part, with few exceptional kind of moments, interested in establishing the usual historical connections, chains of influence. Instead, I think I wrote in the margin at one point, it seems like Andrew is creating constellations of a sort that are visual, conceptual, scientific, cultural. I mean, there are a lot of different things that are being drawn together. And instead of this being at all about, you know, establishing that Malevich could have seen X or could have known X's writing or book or work or, you know, it was about something else. And I imagine that for you, this wasn't a difficult thing to do, to sort of break out of the usual art historical mold. I think for someone like me, I'm like, oh no, I'm never going to get this past peer review. You know, there's no way I can establish that Malevich ever saw that thing from 1617 or, you know, but it creates a kind of vibrancy when you let that go that I found just a pleasure to read. So was there any struggle on your part to let go of the usual chains of influence and establishing who knew who? And
No, there wasn't. It came very easily. I think, I mean, of course, that chronology is very important in some contexts, but in this case, it wasn't. I think in a certain sense, I could have written the book asking and answering the question, what is this painting about? Okay, well, it's about mourning, it's about philosophy, it's about absurdity, and taken a more structured approach. But I didn't want to do that. It's sort of been done in some ways with the conventional narration of the painting, which has been told in a lot of detail, and certainly the influence of the painting, which is ongoing. So really, I wanted to approach the picture with that material, but really what I was doing is setting up resonances. That's what I wanted to do, set up resonances. And to address those issues, but address them in such a way that they weren't explained into analytical a manner, weren't reduced. I didn't want to be reductive, reduce it to its component parts. I wanted to set the sympathetic strings in motion.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you didn't. I'm glad that you did it the way that felt right. And
there are other things I think that I've wondered about other things you could do it with. For instance, take Jackson Pollock and his drip painting. Could you approach that, for instance, through marbling papers or something of this kind? And there were other ways. And I thought, no, that's not really, that wouldn't work in the same way because it would have an arbitrariness about it. It would be like playing just sort of snap with the past. It's easy to find precedents that don't have any inner resonance. But what struck me about this case is that all the precedents have real significance, because every aspect of Malevich's painting that I would choose to discuss, if I were looking at it just in itself, every aspect is somehow accounted for in these other examples. And I thought that was very interesting. And also it raises the question about the almost archetypal power of a rectangle of blackness. What could that express? I think in Western art historical context, we're so attached to pictures. I think it's interesting to consider, for instance, take a 17th century still life painting, which is the most classic kind of old master painting. Every national gallery in the world must have one of these core pictures, but it's actually an extremely unusual kind of picture to produce if you look at the human creativity as a whole. The idea of painting something from our world, perfectly ordinary things in the world, bits of fruit, glasses, knives and forks, in a realistic manner, not, as it were, introducing any kind of distortion to it, is a very obscure thing to do. But we've turned it into a kind of mainstream to such an extent that Malevich's black painting seems extremely odd because it's the opposite of that kind of conventional representation. But why do we represent things? What are we doing? I think it's very interesting. We've got lemons. Why do we paint lemons in a naturalistic way? What does the painting of a lemon have that a lemon doesn't have? So these are sort of very fundamental questions that are part of our artistic culture. And so Malevich's painting seems to be a complete and utter contradiction of that total approach to images altogether. And yet there are these other examples. None of them have artistic pretensions. Malevich's is a work of art, so its narrative context is art history. None of the other black squares that I discussed in the book are works of art. They're all scientific, they're comedic, they're illustrations. So they all serve a slightly different purpose, but it makes you realize how conventional we are in the way we create history, you could say. And so it really questions the conventions of historiography, which is something that I am very interested in.
Yeah, I am too. And maybe that was what struck me so much is that, you know, it pushed in interesting ways against, as you've been saying, the way that we traditionally think, the way history teaches us to think, the way it sort of encourages us to create taxonomies and boxes and put everything in all, you know, on all these spots. And I read books like yours. There aren't many of them, I'll admit, that really give me sort of visions of there could be other methods in art history. There could be other syncretic ways of putting these narratives together that I think do reveal something about your origin point, whatever it is you're trying to actually talk about, in this case, Malevich's Black Square. But there's, as you know, there's resistance outside of curation, I would say, in sort of traditional art historical writing and research. The idea of throwing away chronology, throwing away the chains of influences, you know, it really gets a good number of people's feathers ruffled up, unfortunately.
Well, one doesn't have to get rid of it. I think it's a question of complementing it and seeing that it is a mode of presentation.
Yes, a mode, a method.
It is a mode. It's very useful, very interesting, but there are other ways of approaching it.
Yeah. It did make me think, you know, that maybe one of the hard things about this mode that you use for this book and the vast periods of time you draw together all these different, you know, kinds of objects, let's say, visual images that come from so many different sources, scientific and literary and so on and so forth. At some point, I think I wrote in the margin, How did you, Andrew, stop with this? You know, like once I found myself in the days after I finished the book, sort of seeing black squares everywhere, black rectangular quadrangles and things. And I thought, gosh, I wonder how he finally just said enough. Like, I've got it. This is the book that, you know, it's done. Was there sort of a giant bulletin board or did you have a binder where you were keeping all this? I mean, just how you put it together and how you limit it is so intriguing to me.
It felt natural. It came to a natural pause. I can't really account for it, but I just felt that it's complete and everything I need to say is here. Having said that, I have discovered one or two black squares since publishing it that I would love to have had illustrated in it. I refer to them in the notes, but they were too late to be illustrated. And I hope there will be more. It's an ongoing story.
I should say, too, since you just mentioned the notes, that the notes to this book are fascinating in their own way. And I encourage anyone who picks this up and does end up reading it, do not skip the notes in this particular book. You know, sometimes there isn't a great goldmine of new or extra information in there. But your notes had some bits I was sort of underlining and putting, that's cool, too, like, you know, in the margins and highlighting things. So
I was delighted to discover that in 1915, a postcard maker in Britain produced postcards of seaside towns at night, and they were completely black with a white border around the postcard. Absolutely amazing. With Brighton at night or Eastbourne at night written in the bottom right hand corner, and it was done in 1915. So I thought that was just such a lovely I suppose it takes on more than this merely sort of snap significance on account. It's just a comedy thing on the one hand, but at the same time, these seaside towns did put out their lights in 1915 because they were afraid of bombings from the German Air Force. And so it takes on a slightly more political and military dimension, which ties in with some political resonances in Russia as well. So that's something I mentioned in the notes, but unfortunately didn't get to reproduce in the book. So yeah, the story did trundle on in a certain way, and it will continue to do so.
Good example. I think we've sold the notes well. Everyone's going to be looking at the notes in this book when they end up getting it. I'm looking over, I'm just sort of picking because I'm seeing our time is starting to wind down, so I have to be choosy at this point about what I ask you. Let me ask you this, and it was another thing that didn't strike me till almost to the very end, but I found it interesting. That's such a weak way to put it. I found it intriguing that you don't really engage with Malevich's writings in here, which, as you know, is usually central to all writing on this painting and on him, kind of in suprematism, the movement that this painting ushers in. Was that a deliberate choice from the beginning, or how
Not
did that
particularly.
Come about?
It wasn't a deliberate choice. I did look at the writings, and I used as much material as I thought was relevant, but I didn't find very much material that I thought was particular to the subject. I mean, one, I think, important aspect of it is that it's very passionate and very colourful and quite impulsive, all of which is important because it does give you a sense of Malevich's personality and what a passionate man I think he must have been. And how feverish his imagination was, and sometimes quite inarticulate as well. I think some of his ideas, his writings, are difficult to understand, certainly in translation, but I think in Russian too. I'm not a Russian speaker, so I haven't read them in the original, but I understand that they're pretty difficult to understand in Russian as well, which I think just gives a sense of the feverishness of his imagination. He's not a cold and calculating character. And he described how painting the Black Square itself was a rather passionate moment for him. I think there was the penny dropped for him, and he painted it with, I think, great feverishness.
One of his students left behind a wonderful, often quoted, you know, bit about he couldn't sleep or eat for a week, and you know, yeah, that gives exactly the sense that you're describing of this sort of feverish, hasty, you know, he knew he'd hit on something, and producing it was its own kind of crucible, as far as he described it in later years, significantly later years. I think I could probably get in one or two more questions here. And I have sort of at the very bottom of the notes that I took to maybe ask you what most surprised you about exploring the precursors to the Black Square at this kind of depth? Were there certain discoveries you made or moments where you were like, oh, wow, that's extraordinary?
well, the abundance of the material was surprising. If it had just been two or three, it would have been some happy chances. There's so much material. It began to cohere into an issue for me, elevating it to another level. So that was surprising. I also discovered some very beautiful and touching and intriguing objects. For instance, the morning poetry is heartbreaking, some of it. And the books in which you get black pages, some of them are very, very small. They fit into the palm of your hand and you open them up and page after page is black. And each page is printed with a wood block, and so that each one is slightly different. And especially if you've perhaps been educated into the subtleties of differences of this kind through modern art, probably, I would say I felt each page had its own passionate quality and had something very particular about it. And then you get the text of the elegies that are combined with the black pages is very, very affecting. And I found that quite marvelous.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think of it at one point. You have kind of a section where you talk about the black pages in the novel, The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, right? And I think you use the word that these are, quote unquote, anticipating Malevich's Black Square. And I just immediately thought, oh, like that's such an intriguing notion that, again, I don't think traditional art history gets at enough, this idea that certain things really do anticipate other things, that these resonances occur almost despite to the artists. I mean, it's similar maybe to the way that we often talk about artists don't even necessarily know everything that the works of art they're producing can possibly mean. I mean, that's our job as critics and historians, right, is to come in and draw these connections that artists may have sort of subconsciously placed in there. But yeah, this idea of anticipation it's a special one. I think you really have made a contribution with a book that isn't, you know, something that'll take our listeners weeks to read or something that's a real slog, you know, in terms of it being difficult. Not at all. There's a lot in here that's gold.
Well, I think one thing that's important is that the capacities change. When somebody accomplishes something, they change our capacities, you could say. Ooh. So we might not necessarily be influenced directly by the thing itself, but they've set a new series of possibilities in train. And so we might not be able to identify the source of our own developments because we didn't realize that capacity had, as it were, been bequeathed to us by our predecessors. Ooh, see what I mean by that? That's very, very important, I think. But Tristram Shandy was a marvelous companion all of this time. First of all, it was known in Russia at the beginning of the 20th century, and so it's not inconceivable that Malevich was familiar with its quirky conceits. But it also touches on other nerves. It's both tragic on the one hand and comic on the other. So it bridges those two zones very well, because it's slightly absurd the way he uses a black square or black page in the book. At the same time, it is part of this morning tradition. So it's in both areas there. And also, Lawrence Stern himself did include in the book diagrammatic representations of his own timelines. And so there are lines in the book saying this is how things progressed. And they are literally abstract lines. They're squiggles. And in one or two occasions, they do go backwards. So in his novel, he does have sequences that seem to go backwards in time.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
We don't address that particularly in the book, but Lawrence Stern was very much playing around with these conventions and enjoying the poetry of them, but also enjoying the absurdity of them. So it's mm-hmm. perfectly possible for there to be a kind of humor, but also a kind of depth. They do not need to be separated from each other.
Mm-mm, no, and I think Black Square is a great example of that, right? Humor and depth coexisting for sure in this canvas. Everything you're saying sort of suddenly made me think of a question that I didn't originally intend to ask, but, you know, I intentionally don't usually look at reviews of the books that I'm doing interviews about, maybe because I have sort of my own thoughts and opinions and I don't want them to necessarily be colored by strike me as sometimes arbitrary. Sometimes reviews can be quite juicy and quite good. Have you gotten much feedback from, let me say, especially the strong contingency of Malevich scholars who exist both in Russia and in both the UK and in America? I imagine, Andrew, that they will have opinions on this book. Have you heard at all from them?
Actually, I haven't heard much. The book's only been out for a few months. And so it takes a little bit of time for the review process, I think, to kick in as far as publications are concerned. But informally, I have had a feedback from friends who are academic and involved in the subject, and they've enjoyed it very much. They appreciate that it's a little bit left field, but I think they enjoy that. I think they enjoy it, and I think they, you know, some of these connections were discoveries, so I think they've appreciated that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I certainly did. It was a sort of random, well, I shouldn't say it was altogether random purchase on my part. I have been working, as I mentioned before we started recording the interview, on Malevich research myself. So it was part of this sort of haul where I just went on Amazon and thought, okay, I have books in my office that are somewhat dated on this. What's the newest stuff? And that's how I found your book and just immediately was like, oh, this is such a fresh take. There really are, you know, very intriguing insights in here that I'm going to add in, as I've mentioned, to lectures and to my own writing and things like that. Well, I have taken up a good amount of your time as I'm looking at the clock ticking away here, but I want to ask you the last traditional question on New Books Network, which is just to tell our listeners what you're working on now. What can we look forward to coming out from you in the future?
I'm working on a book about epistemology and about the conventions of knowing. What does it mean to know something? It is a philosophical subject, of course, but I'm looking at it very much in relation to the history of diagrams. And I come to it from an art historical point of view. So it'll be a sort of combination of an art historical approach to diagrams and epistemology. It relates to a couple of books that I wrote just in the last 2 years on selfhood. What is the background to the notion of the personal identity, personal self and personal identity, and how do we substantiate it in the world with cultural conventions? And this is really looking at that subject, the relationship between selfhood and the conventions of knowledge and knowing, especially diagrams. It sounds a little bit esoteric, and it's certainly a challenging subject, but I'm going to make it as popular and accessible as I possibly can, and it will be hopefully illustrated with glorious images. Mm. We'll see. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
As this book was, maybe that's the last thing that I should say in terms of
images are important,
encouraging our listeners to pick up a copy of this is the beautiful full color, glossy illustrations throughout. Well, thank you so much, Andrew, for taking the time to talk to me about this really fascinating little book today. I appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Really enjoyed it.
All right, everybody. You have been listening to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Allison Lee, and I've been talking to Andrew Spira about his new book, Foreshadowed, Malevich's Black Square and Its Precursors. As always, if you have questions or comments about this episode, you can contact me through my website at allison-lee.com or find me on Instagram at Professor Lee. Thanks so much for listening.